The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Continuing with Part 1, The Yoga of Divine Works, Chapter 2, Self-Consecration, on page 78. Concentration is indeed the first condition of any yoga, but it is an all-receiving concentration that is the very nature of the integral yoga, a separate, strong fixing of the thought, of the emotions, or of the will on a single idea, object, state, inner movement, or principle, is no doubt a frequent need here also. But this is only a subsidiary helpful process. A wide, massive opening, a harmonized concentration of the whole being in all its parts, and through all its powers upon the One, who is the All, is the larger action of this yoga, without which it cannot achieve its purpose. For it is the consciousness that rests in the One and that acts in the All to which we aspire. It is this that we seek to impose on every element of our being and on every movement of our nature. This wide and concentrated totality is the essential character of the sadhana, and its character must determine its practice. But even though the concentration of all being on the divine is the character of the yoga, yet is our being too complex a thing to be taken up easily and at once, as if we were taking up the world in a pair of hands and set in its entirety to a single task. Man, in his effort at self-transcendence, has usually to seize on some one spring or some powerful leverage in the complicated machine that his nature is. This spring or lever he touches in preference to others and uses it to set the machine in motion towards the end that he has in view. In his choice, it is always nature itself that should be his guide. But here it must be nature at her highest and widest in him, not at her lowest or in some limiting movement. In her lower vital activities, it is desire that nature takes as her most powerful leverage. But the distinct character of man is that he is a mental being, not a merely vital creature. As he can use his thinking mind and will to restrain and correct his life impulses, so, too, he can bring in the action of a still higher, luminous mentality, aided by the deeper soul in him, the psychic being, and supersede by these greater and purer motive powers the domination of the vital and sensational force that we call desire. He can entirely master or persuade it and offer it up for transformation to its divine master. This higher mentality and this deeper soul, the psychic element in man, are the two grappling hooks by which the divine can lay hold upon his nature. The higher mind in man is something other, loftier, purer, vaster, more powerful than the reason or logical intelligence. The animal is a vital and sensational being. Man, it is said, is distinguished from the animal by the possession of reason. But that is a very summary, a very imperfect and misleading account of the matter. For reason is only a particular and limited, utilitarian and instrumental activity that proceeds from something much greater than itself, from a power that dwells in an ether more luminous, wider, illimitable. The true and ultimate as distinguished from the immediate or intermediate importance of our observing, reasoning, inquiring, judging intelligence, is that it prepares the human being for the right reception and right action of a light from above, which must progressively replace in him the obscure light from below that guides the animal. The latter also has a rudimentary reason, a kind of thought, a soul, a will, and keen emotions. Even though less developed, its psychology is yet the same in kind as man's. But all these capacities in the animal are automatically moved and strictly limited, almost even constituted by the lower nervous being. All animal perceptions, sensibilities, activities are ruled by nervous and vital instincts, cravings, needs, satisfactions, of which the nexus is the life impulse and vital desire. Man, too, is bound, but less bound, to this automatism of the vital nature. Man can bring an enlightened will, an enlightened thought, and enlightened emotions to the difficult work of his self-development. He can more and more subject to these more conscious and reflecting guides the inferior function of desire. In proportion as he can thus master and enlighten his lower self, he is man and no longer an animal. When he can begin to replace desire altogether by a still greater enlightened thought and sight and will in touch with the infinite, consciously subject to a diviner will than his own, linked to a more universal and transcendent knowledge, he has commenced the ascent towards the Superman. He is on his upward march towards the divine. It is, then, in the highest mind of thought and light and will, or it is in the inner heart of deepest feeling and emotion, that we must first center our consciousness. In either of them, or, if we are capable, in both together, and use that as our leverage to lift the nature wholly towards the divine. The concentration of an enlightened thought, will, and heart turned in unison towards one vast goal of our knowledge, one luminous and infinite source of our action, one imperishable object of our motion, is the starting point of the yoga. And the object of our seeking must be the very fount of the light which is growing in us, the very origin of the force which we are calling to move our members. Our one objective must be the divine himself, to whom, knowingly or unknowingly, something always aspires in our secret nature. There must be a large, many-sided, yet single concentration of the thought on the idea, the perception, the vision, the awakening touch, the soul's realization of the one divine. There must be a flaming concentration of the heart on the seeking of the all and eternal, and, when once we have found him, a deep plunging and immersion in the possession and ecstasy of the all beautiful. There must be a strong and immovable concentration of the will on the attainment and fulfillment of all that the divine is, and a free and plastic opening of it to all that he intends to manifest in us. This is the triple way of the yoga. But on that which as yet we know not, how shall we concentrate? And yet we cannot know the divine unless we have achieved this concentration of our being upon him. A concentration which culminates in a living realization and the constant sense of the presence of the One in ourselves and in all of which we are aware is what we mean in yoga by knowledge and the effort after knowledge. It is not enough to devote ourselves by the reading of scriptures or by the stress of philosophic reasoning to an intellectual understanding of the divine. For at the end of our long mental labor, we might know all that has been said of the eternal, possess all that can be thought about the infinite, and yet we might not know him at all. This intellectual preparation can indeed be the first stage in a powerful yoga, but it is not indispensable. It is not a step which all need or can be called upon to take. Yoga would be impossible except for a very few if the intellectual figure of knowledge arrived at by the speculative or meditative reason were its indispensable condition or a binding preliminary. All that the light from above asks of us, that it may begin its work, is a call from the soul and a sufficient point of support in the mind. This support can be reached through an insistent idea of the divine in the thought, a corresponding will in the dynamic parts, an aspiration, a faith, a need in the heart. Any one of these may lead or predominate, if all cannot move in unison or in an equal rhythm. The idea may be, and must in the beginning, be inadequate. The aspiration may be narrow and imperfect, the faith poorly illumined or even is not surely founded on the rock of knowledge, fluctuating, uncertain, easily diminished. Often even it may be extinguished and need to be lit again, with difficulty, like a torch in a windy pass. But if once there is a resolute self-consecration from deep within, if there is an awakening to the soul's call, these inadequate things can be a sufficient instrument for the divine purpose. Therefore, the wise have always been unwilling to limit man's avenues towards God. They would not shut against his entry even the narrowest portal, the lowest and darkest postern, the humblest wicket gate. Any name, any form, any symbol, any offering has been held to be sufficient if there is the consecration along with it. For the divine knows himself in the heart of the seeker and accepts the sacrifice. But still, the greater and wider the moving idea force behind the consecration, the better for the seeker. His attainment is likely to be fuller and more ample. If we are to attempt an integral yoga, it would be as well to start with an idea of the divine that is itself integral. There should be an aspiration in the heart wide enough for a realization without any narrow limits. Not only should we avoid a sectarian religious outlook, but also all one-sided philosophical conceptions which try to shut up the ineffable in a restricting mental formula. The dynamic conception or impelling sense with which our yoga can best set out would be naturally the idea, the sense of a conscious, all-embracing, but all-exceeding infinite. Our uplook must be to a free, all-powerful, perfect, and blissful one and oneness in which all beings move and live and through which all can meet and become one. This eternal will be at once personal and impersonal in his self-revelation and touch upon the soul. He is personal because he is the conscious divine, the infinite person who casts some broken reflection of himself in the myriad divine and undivine personalities of the universe. He is impersonal because he appears to us as an infinite existence, consciousness, and ananda, and because he is the fount, base, and constituent of all existences and all energies, the very material of our being and mind and life and body, our spirit and our matter. The thought, concentrating on him, must not merely understand in an intellectual form that he exists, or conceive of him as an abstraction, a logical necessity. It must become a seeing thought, able to meet him here as the inhabitant in all, realize him in ourselves, watch and take hold on the movement of his forces. He is the one existence. He is the original and universal delight that constitutes all things and exceeds them. He is the one infinite consciousness that composes all consciousnesses and informs all their movements. He is the one illimitable being who sustains all action and experience. His will guides the evolution of things towards their yet unrealized but inevitable aim and plenitude. To him, the heart can consecrate itself, approach him as the supreme beloved, beat and move in him as in a universal sweetness of love and a living sea of delight. For his is the secret joy that supports the soul in all its experiences and maintains even the errant ego in its ordeals and struggles till all sorrow and suffering shall cease. His is the love and the bliss of the infinite divine lover who is drawing all things by their own path towards his happy oneness. On him, the will can unalterably fix as the invisible power that guides and fulfills it and is the source of its strength. In the impersonality, this actuating power is a self-illumined force that contains all results and calmly works until it accomplishes. In the personality, an all-wise and omnipotent master of the yoga, whom nothing can prevent from leading it to its goal. This is the faith with which the seeker has to begin his seeking and endeavor. For in all his effort here, but most of all in his effort towards the unseen, mental man must perforce proceed by faith. When the realization comes, the faith divinely fulfilled and completed will be transformed into an eternal flame of knowledge. Into all our endeavor upward, the lower element of desire will at first naturally enter. For what the enlightened will sees as the thing to be done, and pursues as the crown to be conquered, what the heart embraces as the one thing delightful, that in us which feels itself limited and opposed, and, because it is limited, craves and struggles, will seek with the troubled passion of an egoistic desire. This craving life force or desire soul in us has to be accepted at first, but only in order that it may be transformed. Even from the very beginning, it has to be taught to renounce all other desires and concentrate itself on the passion for the divine. This capital point gained, it has to be taught to desire not for its own separate sake, but for God in the world and for the divine in ourselves. It has to fix itself upon no personal spiritual gain, though of all possible spiritual gains we are sure, but on the great work to be done in us and others, on the high coming manifestation which is to be the glorious fulfillment of the divine in the world, on the truth that has to be sought and lived and enthroned forever. But last, most difficult for it, more difficult than to seek with the right object, it has to be taught to seek in the right manner. For it must learn to desire not in its own egoistic way, but in the way of the divine. It must insist no longer, as the strong separative will always insists, on its own manner of fulfillment, its own dream of possession, its own idea of the right and the desirable. It must yearn to fulfill a larger and greater will, and consent to wait upon a less interested and ignorant guidance. Even from the very beginning, it has to be taught to renounce all other desires and concentrate itself on the passion for the divine. This capital point gained, it has to be taught to desire not for its own separate sake, but for God in the world and for the divine in ourselves. It has to fix upon no personal spiritual gain, though of all possible spiritual gains we are sure, but on the great work to be done in us and others, on the high coming manifestation, which is to be the glorious fulfillment of the divine in the world, on the truth that has to be sought and lived and enthroned forever. But last, most difficult for it, more difficult than to seek with the right object, it has to be taught to seek in the right manner. For it must learn to desire not in its own egoistic way, but in the way of the divine. It must insist no longer, as the strong separative will always insists, on its own manner of fulfillment, its own dream of possession, its own idea of the right and the desirable. It must yearn to fulfill a larger and greater will, and consent to wait upon a less interested and ignorant guidance. Thus trained, desire, that great unquiet harasser and troubler of man and cause of every kind of stumbling, will become fit to be transformed into its divine counterpart. For desire and passion too have their divine forms. There is a pure ecstasy of the soul's seeking beyond all craving and grief. There is a will of Ananda that sits glorified in the possession of the Supreme Beatitudes. When once the object of concentration has possessed and is possessed by the three master instruments, the thought, the heart, and the will, a consummation fully possible only when the desire soul in us has submitted to the divine law, the perfection of mind and life and body can be effectively fulfilled in our transmuted nature. This will be done not for the personal satisfaction of the ego, but that the whole may constitute a fit temple for the divine presence, a faultless instrument for the divine work. For that work can be truly performed only when the instrument, consecrated and perfected, has grown fit for a selfless action. And that will be when personal desire and egoism are abolished, but not the liberated individual. Even when the little ego has been abolished, the true spiritual person can still remain, and God's will and work and delight in him and the spiritual use of his perfection and our fulfillment works will then be divine and done divinely. Our mind and life and will, devoted to the divine, will be used to help fulfill in others and in the world that which has been first realized in ourselves, all that we can manifest of the embodied unity, love, freedom, strength, power, splendor, immortal joy, which is the goal of the spirit's terrestrial adventure. The yoga must start with an effort, or at least a settled turn, towards this total concentration. A constant and unfailing will of consecration of all ourselves to the Supreme is demanded of us. An offering of our whole being and our many-chambered nature to the Eternal, who is the All. The effective fullness of our concentration on the one thing needful to the exclusion of all else will be the measure of our self-consecration to the One who is alone desirable. But this exclusiveness will in the end exclude nothing except the falsehood of our way of seeing the world and our will's ignorance. For our concentration on the Eternal will be consummated by the mind when we see constantly the divine in itself and the divine in ourselves, but also the divine in all things and beings and happenings. It will be consummated by the heart when all emotion is summed up in the love of the divine in itself and for itself, but love too of the divine in all its beings and powers and personalities and forms in the universe. It will be consummated by the will, when we feel and receive always the divine impulsion and accept that alone as our sole motive force. But this will mean that, having slain to the last rebellious straggler the wandering impulses of the egoistic nature, we have universalized ourselves and can accept with a constant happy acceptance the one divine working in all things. This is the first fundamental siddhi of the integral yoga. It is nothing less that is meant in the end when we speak of the absolute consecration of the individual to the divine. But this total fullness of consecration can only come by a constant progression when the long and difficult process of transforming desire out of existence is completed in an ungrudging measure. Perfect self-consecration implies perfect self-surrender. For here, there are two movements with a transitional stage between them, the two periods of this yoga. One of the process of surrender, the other of its crown and consequence. In the first, the individual prepares himself for the reception of the divine into his members. For all this first period, he has to work by means of the instruments of the lower nature, but aided more and more from above. But in the later transitional stage of this movement, our personal and necessarily ignorant effort more and more dwindles, and a higher nature acts. The eternal Shakti descends into this limited form of mortality and progressively possesses and transmutes it. In the second period, the greater movement wholly replaces the lesser, formerly indispensable first action. But this can be done only when our self-surrender is complete. The ego person in us cannot transform itself by its own force or will or knowledge or by any virtue of its own into the nature of the divine. All it can do is to fit itself for the transformation and make more and more its surrender to that which it seeks to become. As long as the ego is at work in us, our personal action is and must always be in its nature a part of the lower grades of existence. It is obscure or half enlightened, limited in its field, very partially effective in its power. If a spiritual transformation, not a mere illumining modification of our nature, is to be done at all, we must call in the divine Shakti to effect that miraculous work in the individual, for she alone has the needed force, decisive, all-wise, and illimitable. But the entire substitution of the divine for the human personal action is not at once entirely possible. All interference from below that would falsify the truth of the superior action must first be inhibited or rendered impotent, and it must be done by our own free choice. A continual and always repeated refusal of the impulsions and falsehoods of the lower nature is asked from us, and an insistent support to the truth as it grows in our parts. For the progressive settling into our nature and final perfection of the incoming informing light, purity, and power needs, for its development and sustenance, our free acceptance of it, and our stubborn rejection of all that is contrary to it, inferior or incompatible. In the first movement of self-preparation, the period of personal effort, the method we have to use is this concentration of the whole being on the divine that it seeks. And as its corollary, this constant rejection, throwing out, catharsis of all that is not the true truth of the divine. An entire consecration of all that we are, think, feel, and do will be the result of this persistence. This consecration, in its turn, must culminate in an integral self-giving to the highest. For its crown and sign of completion is the whole nature's all-comprehending absolute surrender. In the second stage of the yoga, transitional between the human and the divine working, there will supervene an increasing purified and vigilant passivity, a more and more luminous divine response to the divine force, but not to any other. And there will be, as a result, the growing inrush of a great and conscious miraculous working from above. In the last period, there is no effort at all, no set method, no fixed sadhana. The place of endeavor and tapasya will be taken by a natural, simple, powerful, and happy disclosing of the flower of the divine out of the bud of a purified and perfected terrestrial nature. These are the natural successions of the action of the yoga. These movements are indeed not always or absolutely arranged in a strict succession to each other. The second stage begins in part before the first is completed. The first continues in part until the second is perfected. The last divine working can manifest from time to time as a promise. before it is finally settled and normal to the nature. Always, too, there is something higher and greater than the individual which leads him, even in his personal labor and endeavor. Often he may become, and remain for a time, wholly conscious, even in parts of his being permanently conscious, of this greater leading behind the veil. And that may happen long before his whole nature has been purified in all its parts from the lower indirect control. Even he may be thus conscious from the beginning. His mind and heart, if not his other members, may respond to that seizing and penetrating guidance with certain initial completeness from the very first steps of the yoga. But it is the constant and complete and uniform action of the great direct control that more and more distinguishes the transitional stage as it proceeds and draws to its close. This predominance of a greater diviner leading, not personal to ourselves, indicates the nature's increasing ripeness for a total spiritual transformation. It is the unmistakable sign that the self-consecration has not only been accepted in principle, but is fulfilled in act and power. The Supreme has laid his luminous hand upon a chosen human vessel of his miraculous light and power and Ananda. End of chapter 2, Self-Consecration, page 88.